This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It couldn't have been easy for Utah lawmakers to pass a bill that would decriminalize polygamy in this state. This state. You don't just drastically alter a law that's been in place for 125 years without hours of rancorous debate, backroom dealing, tight margins. Only it was pretty easy, or it seems that way. The bill that would make marrying more than one spouse not a felony anymore, but an infraction, less than a misdemeanor. It sailed through the legislature. It passed the Senate unanimously, only had 3 votes against it in the House. The governor has said he's on board. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints didn't breathe a word on record about it. So what happens now? There aren't many issues more fraught, more loaded than polygamy in Utah. And now, it's not legal, but come on, it's like getting a ticket. We're talking about the polygamy bill today. And joining us first on the program is Lee Hale. He covers religion for KUER and, of course, hosts the podcast Preach. It looks at the messiness of faith. And Lee, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Doug.
So just give us a sense of what we know about how this bill came to be, what you know about it anyway, and I guess we'll react to the fact that it seems to have just sailed through the legislature, but was this unexpected? What do we know about this particular bill?
Well, from my perch, and I'm not in the trenches like Lindsey Hansen Park, we'll hear from later, but from where I'm seeing, it is surprising to me that just the pass rate, the 70-3 votes,
yeah,
that is enormously popular. The legislature is 90% LDS church members, and so these are people who have grown up with stigma against polygamy their whole entire lives.
Yep.
An institution that punishes it with excommunication.
So it's kind of a taboo.
It's the taboo.
Yeah.
Like, it is the taboo. I think that the absence of polygamy defines the LDS church as an institution probably more than anything, especially in the Mormon world.
Mm-hmm.
The LDS church likes to own that Mormonness altogether. It doesn't. There's other offshoots. But yeah, I would say that this is the defining quality, and not just for the LDS church, but Utah, the state,
yeah,
right? The LDS
defined also by the non-existence of polygamy, the criminalization of polygamy.
The criminalization of it.
That's how we got in.
Right. I think the manifesto ending polygamy in the LDS church was 1890. And then shortly after that, the Utah Constitution kind of made it this resounding, you know, statement that this was not going to be part of Utah life. There were some plural marriages in the LDS church after that. But
yeah,
but overall, this was like a big defining moment for the church itself and for the state.
Let's explain. You mentioned the Constitution, and so we have to just explain a little bit about the sort of technical language involved here. It's not legalizing it.
No.
It's decriminalizing it. And so explain just what that means. It's treated as an infraction now, so it's still technically, I guess I've heard it described as like a traffic ticket.
That's what I've been told to. That's what I'm hearing, which is huge because this is compared to, in jail time, right? Years in jail potentially for people practicing polygamy openly in the state. That's a big deal. I mean, the analogy in my mind is similar to like what you see happen in states with marijuana, is that often decriminalization comes and then later legalization comes.
Right.
And it is kind of neutering the impact that has kind of defined it for so long. And that seems really big to me, especially because in a lot of fundamentalist communities, the cops and the state are the enemy.
Yeah.
And traditionally it is that you are not safe with anybody who represents the law, which could keep people from getting needed help,
yeah,
if they're leaving or if they are in a polygamous marriage. So this potentially puts law enforcement and the state much less at odds with fundamentalist polygamous groups.
So give us a sense of what you're hearing. Like, how are people reacting to this? I mean, you're plugged into the sort of Mormon networks. I mean, what are people saying? How are they reacting if they are?
Well, a lot of people are excited at the prospect of people who need help, who are like leaving a polygamous marriage or have been in an abusive relationship, that decriminalizing this will give those very vulnerable people help.
Yeah.
Because they will be less timid, less scared, and less at risk with law enforcement. But speaking from the LDS church community, there is still a lot of anxiety around polygamy, and I feel it and I hear it. A lot of people wonder, if it's not illegal, does that give a potential green light or an open door to the LDS church practicing polygamy again, which I think most members of the LDS Church would say is ridiculous.
Yeah.
But that anxiety is still there. It's important to note that on a very real level, the LDS Church still practices plural marriage. A man can be sealed, married for eternity to more than one woman.
And we should point out that two members of the governing first presidency of the LDS Church fit into that category.
And I should say this is when death is involved.
Yes, of course.
If you're sealed to a spouse, and if you're a man, women, it's not the same for women. Yes, the two top leaders of the church are sealed to two women.
So polygamy exists in an afterlife, basically.
It does exist in an afterlife. And Peggy Fletcher Stack at the Salt Lake Tribune did an excellent piece last fall about this anxiety.
My dear brothers and sisters, a letter I received some time ago.
Dallin Oaks, second in command in the church, kind of made a joke last general conference about polygamy in the afterlife. He said that a woman reached out to him who was a second wife and said,
would she be able to have her own house in the next life? Or would she have to live with her husband and his first wife? I just told her to trust the Lord.
A lot of people took issue with that being a joke.
Yeah.
And laughing about this thing doesn't feel like a laughing matter. So I think that it's always been felt safe to say that this is just completely opposed to the LDS way of life. And I think this might give an opening into some people's minds as to maybe the future.
What did Dallin Oaks say in that speech? It seems like one of the things he mentioned was for people not to just don't worry about it. Like
trust the Lord.
Yeah,
that's the line. Trust the Lord, and that's the reasoning for much of what is said about the afterlife that seems confusing or contradictory. I will just say that this is something that, and this is where I need to invoke my own upbringing in the LDS Church. I think it causes so much anxiety because the stigma is so strong. I think every person who grows up in the LDS Church hates when people are compare them to the polygamists or fundamentalists they've seen on a TV show, or there's an article about FLDS or Warren Jeffs in the past, and the word Mormon is used, and you get asked about it. It was something that I wanted to avoid at all costs.
Yeah.
I didn't like it. The stigma I felt towards me as a Mormon from outsiders, I then foisted upon fundamentalists and polygamists. That kind of, skepticism, maybe even verging on hatred, because...
And you grew up, we should just mention, you grew up outside of the state.
I grew up outside the state, grew up in L.A., and so it was a decently big Mormon community. But yes, even there, outside of Utah, that was felt. And I carried that with me my whole upbringing, and through when I served as a missionary for the church, I was told when I served in 2008 that if somebody grew up in a polygamous home, they need first presidency approval to get baptized. They have to renounce the act, and they have to go all the way to the top to even enter the church. It was the biggest taboo. And that stays with you. That's significant. That affects the culture at large.
It's interesting. One of the things I want to talk to our next guest about is some of what she's talked about is her own preconceived notions about these communities. And I wanted to ask you about your own preconceived notion as you went not so long ago on a reporting trip, basically, to the FLDS community of Short Creek.
Yeah.
You've talked about it having a kind of, I don't know, it seems like a kind of a profound effect. I think this is how you put it, as kind of a mystical effect on you.
It was a profound trip. I think that, and I should say that Short Creek, also known Colorado City,
right,
Arizona, and Hilldale, Utah, it's a shared community. I was told that when Warren Jeffs and the FLDS Church was at its strongest, that if you were avoiding state police, you could hop the border because the community was over two state lines, or over a state line. These days, Short Creek is now full of people who have left that community,
right,
who have left that faith. And the state has taken over much of the land and kind of redistributing it, especially right now. So I went there and I could sense immediately my anxiety. This was a place that I always worried about and looked down on. I wanted nothing to do with FLDS. I wanted nothing to do with the Short Creek community. I was invited to go cover a Halloween party at an elementary school. And the thing that surprised me so much was when I got there is how familiar everyone felt to me.
Have fun? These kids are ready to go, man.
Oh, yeah.
They've waited long enough.
There was this Mormon warmth and community that was like so... I felt it on a deeply spiritual level.
Wow.
And it
Wait,
kinda,
like estranged cousins.
Estranged cousins, exactly. And it kind of freaked me out.
I will have to send you some pictures of my first trunk or treat we did.
Yeah, I'd love to see the difference.
I did not expect that. I had this arm's length distance thing, and it quickly came down because I saw that these we come from the same roots. We share so much history, and I have avoided this community my whole entire life.
I feel like the whole town's here, right?
Oh, yeah. Not really.
Not quite.
But I'm telling you, this is how you create the healing. This is how you win. Hearts and minds. This is how you win from the inside.
And I think it would be extremely healthy for the state to heal in that way as well, to stop looking with disdain and to welcome these people who they've shared land with, culture with, history with. But polygamy is the thing that gets in the way.
What can we say? What should we make of the fact that the LDS Church has basically made no statement? And I should just mention that the church doesn't appear to have taken an on-the-record position on this particular bill. They haven't made any official statement for it or against it. We reached out to the church, I should say, also to ask a representative to join us on the program or at least provide some sort of comment on it, but they declined the offer. The entry for polygamy on the LDS Newsroom website just starts with this sentence. Today, the practice of polygamy is strictly prohibited in the church as it has been for over a century.
Yep.
They're not saying anything, and which is remarkable that they're not at least saying out of the question.
Yes. I'm not surprised they're not saying anything.
Huh.
I think that it passed with such a majority of the House means that there's no backdoor dealings of them telling people not to vote because the church is very influential either publicly or behind the scenes.
Right.
These are,
and as you said, 90% of lawmakers are part of that church.
So at very least, it means that they're just kind of being silent bystanders.
Right.
If they were to come out in support, I think that would raise a lot of questions, and that could still happen, or opposed, but I don't think they want to be connected to it. That's my hunch. I will say the most recent statement I know of that involves kind of this world of fundamentalism or polygamy was when there was those awful murders in Mexico last fall, and this was a family tied that had Mormon roots in Mexico and fundamentalist roots, and in the statement... The statement from the LDS Church said, "We are heartbroken to hear of the tragedy." And then the spokesman, Eric Hawkins, quickly says, "Though it is our understanding they are not members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, our love, prayers, and sympathies are with them." So like a very clear disclaimer in just two lines, they are not members of this church. And that's kind of been the church's go-to thing for so long, is point out the difference, point out the difference, point out the difference. So them being... arm's length away is not surprising to me.
So now that this bill is on its way to becoming a law, do you think this is going to require some rethinking, some reorienting of the issue for Latter-day Saints in this state or everywhere?
Maybe. I think the biggest question for me is about stigma.
Yeah,
it's one thing to decriminalize something. It's another thing to destigmatize something. And I think that most Latter-day Saints, members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, are going to be very anxious about being associated or in support in any way of fundamentalist communities. There are outliers. There are people who see needs in these communities and are part of them. And that I think they are still kind of – that's the exception, not the rule. I wonder if this will have an effect on the stigma. I think that there's a good chance it could. It certainly will have an effect on, I think, how fundamentalist communities view the state themselves, I mean, the state itself, that stigma, the idea that it is us against them, that you are not safe here, that it is, you know, almost combative. I think that certainly will die down.
So what difference will this make, do you think, in the end?
Outside of the law changing, I don't know. I don't know if it'll be a huge cultural conversation. I don't know if it'll be talked about in LDS church buildings. I do think that it puts this idea in the mind of people who probably make a point not to think about it very often. and to kind of confront it in a different way. And I think that is significant. I think that people revisiting the topic and revisiting people who they distance themselves from will have an impact. I don't know how large, but I'll just say for my group messages alone on my phone that we're talking about it. Mormons are talking about it. We're curious. Some are anxious, and others are very open to this idea.
It's Lee Hale. He hosts the podcast Preach. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Joining us now on the program is Lindsay Hansen-Park. She's host of the podcast The Year of Polygamy. She's also the executive director of the Sunstone Education Foundation, joining us here in the studio. And welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So where did this come from, this bill that now is on its way to becoming a law? What do we know about the origins of this?
Well, there has long been the debate, probably for several decades now in the state, of what to do with this polygamy problem, if you will. I think it's a collective wound for this entire state. Our statehood is tied to it. When Mormons first started practicing polygamy secretly in Illinois, it was against the law. Bigamy was a crime. They come to what was then Mexico to sort of live their religion in, you know, with relative freedom, and the federal government pushes all of these laws for a long time. So criminalization has been on the books for a long time, for almost a century. And there have been differing agendas and ideas and attitudes about what to do, because criminalization is not enforced. You know, law enforcement does not enforce. They're not busting up polygamous marriages or anything like that. So some people have suggested that decriminalization is the way to go. Yeah. There was a bill that was passed a few years ago, back in mid-2000s, lasts for about 2.5 years. And then anti-polygamy activists have gotten it recriminalized, because that's where the debate is.
Right.
I heard that this bill was tried. They tried to run it last year, but it wasn't the right time. And so this year it came again. But it's important to know that this bill is not full decriminalization. It reduces polygamy to an infraction, which means you can still report on it. So you can go, if you know you're in a polygamous marriage and you want to report on your husband, you can go and he'll get like a— it's like a speeding ticket. But there is an enhancement to this bill, which means that if he's abusive or there's sexual abuse or fraud, or those crimes are enhanced back to a felony status. So it was sort of a compromise from advocates saying, all right, we know criminalization isn't working. It's not being enforced. How can we make it enforced while still removing the barrier of fear from people that are afraid to report? Because folks like Warren Jeffs would have used the criminalization status to, you know, disempower its victims. If you're being abused by a family member, you don't want to go forward because you're told your whole family is going to go to jail.
Yeah. It's interesting when I see what you've written about plural marriage, about the practice of polygamy. You say it's hard. I don't like it. It's systematic discrimination. It commodifies women. You've seen what you've described as true horrors as a result of all of this. But you are supportive of this bill, supportive of this becoming a law. Explain what seems like a contradiction there.
It hasn't always been this way. I hated polygamy. I grew up in the LDS church. We're told it's weird and wicked and gross, but our heaven's going to be that way. So I have a unique position that a lot of people don't have. I have a lot of trust and access to isolated groups that people don't know about. Everyone thinks of the FLDS, and that is absolutely one group that we have considered in this decision. But there are over 400 Mormon groups across the spectrum, and many of them practice polygamy. And after meeting with them and talking with them, I have become more and more convinced that criminalization is not the way. If criminalization were enforced, then I would support it. But it's not enforced. I've sat for hours in the Office of Law Enforcement Officials hearing why they can't enforce it. It's nearly impossible to enforce, especially these people know what they're doing. They know how to do these spiritual marriages, how to get around cohabitation laws. Utah has the strictest laws of polygamy on the books, and we have the most polygamists in the state.
It's just creating polygamists, you've said.
I don't even know if you can say it's creating polygamists, but it's certainly not deterring polygamists. Hmm. And the doctrine of Mormon polygamy is unique because it doesn't respect the laws of the land. So criminalization, we are finding as advocates who are trying to get resources to victims and survivors in the most isolated situations, it's not going to solve the problem of polygamy. It's only going to remove one more barrier to reporting these crimes.
I wanted to ask you, what is it that interests you about this practice and that you've devoted so much time and still continue to devote so much time talking to people within this practice? One of the things you've written about is that how you struggled, this is how you put it, struggled to accept some of the nuances that challenged your preconceived notions about plural marriage in these communities where it's practiced. Talk to me a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, like I said, as an LDS woman, not growing up in it, I mean, people will always ask me now, why are you so obsessed with this? Are you a polygamist? No. No, I'm not. Yeah. Never going to be. But I hated it. I thought it was deeply unfair. As a Mormon feminist, it hurt my soul to a deep core level, knowing that it affected me in these ways. And so I started researching it to sort of disprove it, right? Like we were going to find out that we didn't have to practice it. And I actually was able to successfully do that in my own mind, researching the origins of the practice. I don't think they're divine. I don't think they're of God. But it also allowed me access to people who do believe those things. And when I was confronted with not just one or two stories, but hundreds of stories of people that lived it and left, people that lived it and stay, I had to change my mind with new information. And, and what it is I've never, you know, liked polygamy, but the abuses and crimes and things that people are talking about are more a result of the isolation and the secrecy than they are of that practice itself. I mean, most people love their mothers. They have multiple mothers. They have good experiences with that. What they're upset about is not getting justice for the abuse, for the coercion, for the spiritual abuse. And of course, those end up in polygamous systems. But it's too simple to say that polygamy is the answer.
So stay with us. I want to give you a chance to respond to some of the kind of specific opposition to the bill. Earlier, we spoke with Melissa Ellis. A number of years ago, she left a polygamous group known as the Davis County Cooperative Society, also known as the Kingston Group. And she's, of course, been speaking out against the bill. Proponents often make the argument that by criminalizing polygamy, that it basically what happened is it drove the practice underground, that it taught people not to report crimes or fear law enforcement. But Ellis told us that misses an important point.
The way that I was raised, it's going to be used as a control tactic. It's going to be used as God answered their prayers and has made it legal now. And anybody that was thinking of leaving, that was sitting on the fence, is now going to be putting themselves down because now God has given them an answer that they were searching for, that the government now agrees with it. And we were taught our whole lives that it was going to become legal again, that God was going to make that happen. But I was not taught to fear law enforcement, to fear the law. I was taught that what we were doing technically wasn't against the law, which technically it's not. They don't live bigamy, they live polygamy, and the law is all about bigamy. And so we were taught that it wasn't what was on the books. What we were doing was not what was on the books, and it's technically correct. It's not.
Yeah.
But yeah, it wasn't the law that was stopping me from leaving. It was that fear for my soul, and that's what most of the polygamists, we're God-fearing people, and so that's what we feared, was what God would think, not what man would think.
Can a woman, a very young woman, or any woman for that matter, can a woman truly consent to enter into a plural marriage, or is it so bound up with, as you were mentioning, religious culture, this idea about your relationship with God, and also so bound up in a patriarchy that it's difficult for a woman in these cases to be an independent actual agent in all of this? Can they give consent, do you think?
So that is one of my questions with the bill, is how are they going to define consenting adults? If somebody is brainwashed their entire life as soon as they turn 18 and get married, then are they really a consenting adult? Like my daughters were 4 and 5 and came to my home and told me they had just spent the time with their dad and told me that when they're 14 and 15, they're going to get married to the same man. They didn't know who, but their dad did. And so it's taught at such a young age. One of my cousins, they were trying to get her to marry her first cousin at 15. Well, it didn't happen till she was 16, and she was forced and beaten into that marriage. And so she had her first kid at 17, and she was one of his plural wives. And so, yeah, the brainwashing is there and the physical abuse is there on children to get them to do what their parents or the leader wants them to do. And in the end, in the Kingston group, the leader has the last say. So the leader decides who's going to marry who and gives that permission. So I don't feel like a woman really has the choice to make a pure self-consenting relationship decision.
Talk a little bit more about what you see as problematic with the way the bill has been written, because you say the language raises in some ways more questions than it answers.
Yeah, some of the language she took out of the bill was that before, a defense for somebody leaving a polygamous-bigamous relationship was that they didn't know they couldn't live that way. So say somebody is a truck driver. They marry someone in one state and then marry somebody in another state, and then one of those people find out. Then that would be a defense for them leaving and not being prosecuted for it, as they didn't know. That wording is taken out of there, and I don't understand why. There is the coercion on there, but I don't know that is that on the coercion line or not. There is just some wording.
You say it's vague.
Yeah, it is very vague. There's a lot more that needs to go into it, like the consenting adults. Is it just the husband and the new person marrying that has to be consenting? Does if there's 27 wives, which the Kingston leader, Paul, he has 27 wives, four of which are his half-sisters. Would he have to get every single one of their permission? Do they all have to consent to the next wife coming in? Like, what is considered a consenting adult? It doesn't say. And what in the infraction, what are the fees going to be? What's going to happen? Because even with a speeding ticket, you have to pay a fine and you're not supposed to do it again.
Yeah.
Is that what's going to happen? Do they have to pay a fine and say that they're going to stop doing this and they're not going to take on any more wives, or what is going on? So, yeah, there
needs to
be more.
You said that's not clear in the bill either.
It's not.
If this is not prosecuted now, even though it's on the books, what would change? Why would this law now change anything?
I agree with that. Like, why is it going to change? Really, they've moved around the wording that was in there before, because those associated abuses were listed before. So they've moved that wording around and they've added in that consenting adults, it would be an infraction. But it isn't being prosecuted now. It has been being reported with the child abuse. My niece, she was 16 and ran away. And she went to the Children's Justice Center and she said, I'm being forced to marry my much older uncle. I don't want to go back. Well, they kept her for 24 hours, sent her back. Last year at 17, she's now married because she just got sent back. Well, she reported that and nothing happened with it. And that was one of my questions in a private meeting with Senator Henderson. I said, well, they are being reported. The child abuse is being reported. Like, what is going to make it prosecutable? What is going to change? And she couldn't give me an answer on it. So that is still my question. So if people do start coming forward, I'd like to know it be publicly made that it's coming forward and see what happens, see if it's actually going to be prosecuted.
You hear the argument that, look, it's so complicated, this cannot be prosecuted. What do you make of that argument?
I feel that it is prosecutable. It's the human beings that have the knowledge, have the degrees to be attorneys that are prosecutors that are refusing to do it.
Why? Why are they refusing to do it, do you think?
I know that Sean Reyes has said before that if you're going to bring me a bigamy case and you're going to bring me a child abuse case, two different cases, he's going to choose to prosecute the child abuse over the bigamy. In my mind, there's no separating polygamy from the associated abuses that happen, from the child abuse, from the domestic violence. Any control tactic is the associated abuses that are being used. So they know that they go hand in hand. So what is changing this law, leaving the wording the way that it is, just adding an infraction, going to do for the victims?
What does Senator Henderson or anyone else who supports the bill, what do you think they're getting for this? What do you think they're looking for? What are they getting in return, or what are they hoping to accomplish, do you think?
I don't know. I've had a lot of people say that to me and say we need to look at her contributions, like who's paying her. And, you know, from the history of knowing that, like, Washakie Renewable Energy donated to Sean Reyes, is something like that going on here as well? Is she getting paid to do this? We don't know. I don't know why she's pushing this bill the way that she is.
You've said that there aren't very many people, if any, who have actually left these families, this practice, who is for the bill. Now, I know you can't speak for everyone, but I just wanted you to say something about that.
So from the people that I've talked to, people from the AUB group and the Kingston group and some independents that I personally know, a couple hundred, have told me that they agree with me that it's not going to be helping the victims, that it's going to be used as a control tactic. And we can all visualize it in our head how it's going to work, that it passes, the governor signs it, the leader's going to get up in church, and he's going to verbally abuse everybody that was on the fence or thinking, whether he knows personally they were or not, and belittle them and tell them that they have to repent for their thoughts. And we can all just imagine it in our heads happening, because that's what's going to happen. It's going to be used as that control tactic. And just from the testimonies we've heard, like I've said, I've heard people on the pro side that are in polygamy. So these people don't feel like anything they're doing is wrong, but they know it's illegal, but they're doing it anyways. So again, why are we changing the law to help people that are knowingly violated?
What do you think the consequences of this will be?
I wonder if Utah's ready for it. I feel like Utah is going to be a safe haven for polygamy, and that's not going to just be Mormon polygamy. That's going to be polygamy of different cultures. There's Muslim polygamy as well, and independents, and just all different kinds of religions that believe in polygamy. So now I feel like more people are going to come here that are already living it, and maybe people that were wondering about living it, they're probably going to start doing it now that they can. But I also feel like the welfare fraud's going to go up. Hmm. You're going to have a family of 10 people or more that are going to legitimately together be able to qualify for welfare. It's hard enough with two working parents for a lot of people to make ends meet. Now you're going to have one man and five women or more. Are they going to be able to make ends meet? I don't see that happening. In the Kingston group, they live in separate houses. And I just know how it was being a single mom renting a place. It was hard to make ends meet. And then now I'm married, and me and my husband, we have 8 kids together, and we're able to make ends meet. But it's a lot of hard work. But a lot of the times with the woman in the polygamous relationship, they're a single mom, and they're going to be having to pay their rent or their mortgage, buy food and everything like that. But I just don't know if Utah's ready for the consequences that's going to come along with it.
Is there a law that would make a difference in your point of view?
I feel like there needs to be more education bills to help educate people. Like I said, I didn't know till months of therapy that I was being abused and that my kids were being abused. And if there was like maybe an education bill to hand out pamphlets when people do get welfare or go to the doctor and things like that, that they can see and learn that there are abuses going on. Things like that would help. More reparations funds to help people get out, more funding for the organizations that are helping people get out and educating people and helping people get a higher education. I was the first person that Holding Out Help helped that had a high school diploma. They had helped hundreds of people before me, and I was the first one to have a high school diploma. So more things to help people get that education would be good, and to help those organizations with what they do to protect people.
Melissa Ellis, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Melissa Ellis. She's the vice president of an anti-polygamist organization called Sound Choices Coalition. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
On the latest episode of Preach, I talked to the creator of a gripping documentary podcast called Growing Up Mooney. He was raised in the Unification Church, which he now calls a cult.
The story needed to be told, and through the process of telling the story, I changed as a person in a way that allowed me to grow bigger than all the terrible things that have happened to me.
The story of escaping a cult and rebuilding a life on Preach. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been discussing the news that Utah lawmakers yesterday overwhelmingly passed a bill that would decriminalize polygamy. And we've been talking about what that means for a practice that's been so controversial and provocative for so many years in this state. We have with us Lindsay Hansen-Park. She's been researching plural marriage and working in polygamous communities for years now. She hosts a podcast called The Year of Polygamy. And let's talk about what you were hearing from Melissa Ellis. We don't have to go through all of this, but let me just start with getting your reaction to some of the things that Melissa talked about. That what you're going to get in some of these communities is this idea that this law represents an answer to prayers and that it's just going to make it easier for people to abuse victims and those kinds of things. How did you react to that general reaction?
Well, first of all, I want to say that Melissa is absolutely right. Victims are not getting the justice that they need. That is a huge problem in the state that all advocates, I think, were working for. And, you know, Melissa had a really horrible experience. She's seen it firsthand. And so I am very sympathetic to her arguments. Part of the problem is there's this misunderstanding. We're talking as if we're legalizing polygamy. We're not legalizing it. So a lot of the arguments that are being used on the opposing this bill are telling you statistics of how bad polygamy is for people. And I don't think anyone is arguing those. I think what we're trying to argue is what does this bill do towards those arguments? And criminalization, Melissa is right. It has not been enforced. People do not enforce it. And unfortunately, leaders have used criminalization in the same ways that Melissa is worried that they will use decriminalization. So their leader, Paul Kingston, I've heard from many victims who say he'll go up and, you know, show pictures of himself with the attorney general or something and say, see, this is why you can't report because I'm in with the government. It's been a huge stumbling block. There's a lot of fear, especially in that group in particular, with getting justice.
Yeah.
But we also have the other side of it where, you know, we can play tapes of Warren Jeffs saying, if you come forward, if you report things, your mother will be taken away. You'll lose your sisters. You'll lose your family. This is why it's so complicated from group to group. And all, you know, she says that a lot of victims don't feel heard by this bill. And that is true. When this bill passed, there was so much pain from a lot of people who have left because they are looking for anything to give them justice. And at least criminalization was a symbol of the state's commitment, I guess, to eradicate polygamy. But the state is pretty apathetic, as we know. So we think that decriminalization is worth a shot. So it's important to note.
Not perfect, but worth something.
It's not a solution.
But do you think it dismantles the system of oppression? I mean, like, what does it do?
No, I don't think you can have. There's no silver bullet for this problem. It's a huge, huge beast. And so you have to take it brick by brick. What decriminalization does is just honor the truth, which is that nothing is being done about this bill. We've also looked to other states. A lot of people, you know, there was this argument that if we decriminalize polygamy, it's going to become a safe haven here. Actually, a lot of states have already decriminalized polygamy. Utah has the harshest laws, as I pointed out. We have the most polygamists per capita. No one is fleeing to these other states. That's just not going to happen. A lot of, like, Muslim communities, for example, they are rooted in the Midwest. There's no incentive for them to come here. And so I find those arguments kind of prejudice. Yeah. I mean, it's invoking a religious fear. I'm interested in the communities that I know and work with here. And I think that what we're seeing is that there's not justice being done. So what this does is it's not full decriminalization either. And people need to realize that we're not saying polygamy is legal. It's still illegal. It's in the Utah Constitution that it will always be illegal. Utah has a very storied history with this. What it's saying is we are going to take that away so you can't give the persecution complex to a lot of these groups. And you know, I've heard that even from the Kingston group. They will say, you know, we're so persecuted. We've had our kids taken away. There's a stigma that because we're polygamous that nobody listens to us. And unfortunately, that is the case. I mean, we heard stories from a lot of survivors who were for this bill saying, my mother couldn't get a driver's license when she was fleeing an abusive marriage and she died because of that. Because of the stigma against polygamists. So what we're trying to do is remove that barrier while still allowing victims access to justice. So if you're leaving an abusive relationship and it's polygamous, you can go in and report the polygamy infraction. It will be slapped with a fee. But any of the abuse will get an enhanced felony. So that's why it's not completely decriminalized. And I think there's just a lot of misunderstanding. People are talking about these arguments as if we're talking about legalizing it or criminalizing it. And that's just not the discussion we're having.
It seems like the sense is that people are – that the bill is about, look, this is for consenting adults. If consenting adults can do this, we'll just make it accessible for consenting adults. But it seems like what you're saying is that's not what is motivating it. What's motivating this is, while it may not be perfect, some attempt at actually, as you say, being transparent about what's really going on and taking a first step to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, we have talked to hundreds and hundreds of people over the course of many years, but especially lately, the stories have flooded in from people who are scared. I mean, we're talking about – there's a lot of discussions happening online, and I want to remind people, the fact that you have access to the internet at all shows that you have a privilege that a lot of these people that we're dealing with don't have access to. Mm. And those are the people that we're the most concerned about, because victims are not getting justice. That is true. It's true across the board. Rape cannot be prosecuted anywhere in this nation sufficiently. It's a problem. Child abuse is a problem in all the communities. In my own LDS community, we have a hard time getting justice for that. And an underage marriage is a problem. I mean, any of us that grew up in the LDS community, most of our grandmothers were 16 and 17 when they got married. And the only difference, it wasn't polygamy that changed that. It was having access to public opinion and resources and public awareness campaigns. And so we're trying to get those to these isolated communities, but they're so scared. There's so much fear. I spoke to a woman who is in a plural marriage, and she says, I have a job that I can lose. And she said, I worry every day I'm going to lose my child. Now, the argument for that would be, well, just don't live polygamy. But when you're born into a system, this is where coercion laws get really slippery, because people choose this. And I say, okay, we can't simultaneously like villainize victims of polygamy and say all polygamists are bad, all polygamy is evil, and then expect them to come out and say, but you're fine now only if you leave. People's families are codified after this. So people can lose their religious framework and they're still a family. So what, and they have to make sense of that, right? You know, you have kids and families for 25 years with your sister wives. And you're supposed to leave just because society says that, you know, that's how we're only going to treat you as a victim if you leave. So this idea of consenting adults is only a fraction of it. Because, yes, unfortunately, this is very hard for me to admit, but there are people that openly choose this, people that didn't grow up in it. We have to consider the Constitution. We have to consider what laws are viable and work within that framework. And I think this is... it's not a perfect solution. It's not going to solve the problem, but it will help the people in the worst of the worst of situations.
What do you make of the fact that the LDS Church is not taking an on-the-record stand on this?
I think it's pretty unprecedented. I think that's historical. They have spent a century sort of fighting it, backing it. I will say that their news outlets, the Deseret News and KSL, are still, you know, hosting a majority of anti-polygamy arguments. And I think that that's interesting. And you know, I can only speak to what I've heard. And what I've heard is they have tried to stop the bill from being run before.
Yeah.
They asked to, you know, maybe to hold off last year. And then this year they decided they were going to stay out of it. And I know they were, you know, there was a lot of concern that it would embarrass the missionary program, that if we somehow decriminalize it, then people are going to think that Mormons are converting people to polygamy. And I'm like, people already think that. That's what they think about us.
Yeah.
And again, polygamy is decriminalized in a lot of places. And I don't think that there's any evidence to show that it is causing polygamists at all. So I think the LDS Church is starting to see that fighting hard against it has had sort of the opposite effect. At least that's my hope.
So I wanted to go back to something we were talking about earlier, and that is this kind of complicated relationship between the LDS Church and plural marriage, officially disavowed. It's a reason to get your membership removed from the faith, but still some vestigial, you know, elements within the doctrine. We were talking with Lee about this before. So there are – in the afterlife, there's sort of polygamy still within Mormonism. So what are you making of that? And how are the Mormon women that you're talking to, not women in plural marriage, but in Latter-day Saint wards that you're talking to, what are they thinking about all of this?
Well, this – nothing triggers everybody in the state like the P word, polygamy. It's just everybody has an opinion. And I think that's because LDS people have a unique relationship to the doctrine because we've spent a century trying to like adamantly distance ourselves and change our doctrine. I think Lee said this, the absence of it speaks volumes because we had to fill in the absence of this really critical doctrine with other things. And so we have. In the course of that, we have sort of villainized polygamists. I consider that being complicit in sort of the isolation of groups like the FLDS. As long as they're weird and wicked and criminal, then we don't want to have anything to do with them. And that makes it really hard for people to seek help from outsiders. LDS women especially are worried. There was this huge, huge pushback that I got from LDS women saying, why would you want to normalize polygamy? Why are you trying to bring it back? And I think it comes from a fear that they're worried because it's still in our canon that it's going to be brought back. And I had to say, we're not normal. There's nothing normal about polygamy. You can't normalize it. We're not legalizing it. We're just, and I wanted to remind LDS women, this isn't about your next life. This is about helping victims who are living it now get access to resources now. If you're worried about it in the next life, take that up with your church. Don't take it up with the legislature.
Do you worry now? You mentioned that there is a lot of division in these communities now over this idea in this bill. Do you worry now the fact that you've come out and talked about it in support of the bill, not being perfect, but being some step in the right direction, that it's going to affect your work, affect your relationships in those communities? Are you worried about that?
Yeah, I mean, nuance is lost on Mormons. We're very black and white in our thinking, right? We want good and evil and it to be a struggle. This is a very complicated issue because the approaches over time have sort of layered this patina of pain and discrimination that has affected all of us. So I wrote an op-ed in the Salt Lake Tribune where I say polygamy, I don't like it. Like you said, you read the quotes.
Yep.
At the risk of my polygamous relationships, you know, on the opposition, they'll say, you don't care about victims. You don't care. You just love polygamists. You just want to make polygamists look good. And I'm like, have you met me? Do you know my work? And I think my work stands on its own. And what people respect about me is that I try to be fair. I try to consider both sides. And I've heard the stories of hundreds and hundreds of survivors and victims. And, you know, I've been in the trenches. Like we said, this isn't just something I'm coming on the radio to talk about. I've helped women move out in the dead of night from their abusive relationships. I've been involved in federal investigations. I've put my own life on the line. So I'm not really worried about that. I am disappointed at the whole sort of discourse. It's very toxic because, like I said, this is a wound. People are speaking from trauma. There's a lot of character assassinations. I don't think I anticipated that, and that's why I don't like politics. But I deeply believe we want the same things. We want abuse to stop. We want people to have choices. I want people to have resources. I want them to make the most empowering decisions for themselves. And I think the only disagreement we have is how to do that. No one is saying that polygamy isn't something that we need to look at, that it's not harmful to women. We're saying, okay, now what do we do about it?
That's Lindsay Henson Park. She is host of the podcast, The Year of Polygamy, executive director of the Sunstone Education Foundation. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Lindsay is the host of the podcast, The Year of Polygamy, and the executive director for the Sunstone Education Foundation. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Ali Vallarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.